5.
Mr. Jones, Mrs. Delpy said in her radio voice, Martin's locked himself in his room again. Roscoe felt goose pimples erupt through his neck skin. He closed his eyes. Martin.
I'll be up in a minute, he said slowly, already dawdling.
Bless you, she said. The front door will be unlocked. A half hour later, Roscoe let himself into the Delpy's apartment. He could hear Mrs. Delpy down the hall, speaking in her languid, liquid voice to the door. Mama's making brownies, Martin. Would you like to help me? Come on now, open up so you can stir the batter. She spoke evenly, with warmth and depth, modulating every word. Roscoe tipped his head so his ear would catch her voice. He'd often wished over the past 5 years she and Martin had lived in his building that Mrs. Delpy would come to his room and sit on the foot of his bed and speak sonorous nothings into the dark until he fell asleep. Even if she did nothing more than count, even if she only read names from the phone book, he knew he would slide past the demons into sleep like a child. With a voice like hers, she could be a hypnotist or a meteorologist on national television, or even an actress. But she was none of those things, and not just because she weighed almost 400 pounds and had a snaggled front tooth and let her stringy gray hair grow long and uneven. For all Roscoe knew, Mrs. Delpy might not even know she possessed the voice of an angel or the power of hypnos. She seemed, in fact, to care about nothing except for two things: her son, Martin, and Jesus. Martin, my love, please open the door. It's not good for you to be shut away like that, alone.
God is with me,
Martin said, muffled from behind the door.
What's that? God is with me.
Roscoe stepped into the hall. Mrs. Delpy sank with great effort to her knees. She put a hand against the door and bent her face closer to the jamb.
God is indeed with you, my darling, she said in her honeyed tone. But he doesn't want you to be otherwise alone.
Roscoe closed his eyes. He almost believed her. Open the door, sweet baby. Come to Mama. Roscoe floated forward toward her, drawn by the gravity of her elocution. He could hardly feel his feet crossing the length of the hallway, but there he was, standing suddenly behind her. He had to close his eyes for the magic to work. He hated to admit it, but he needed her voice to become disembodied to enjoy it fully. The contrast between her slovenly exterior and that piezoelectric quiver was stark to the point of distraction.
Open the door.
Nothing. Then the muffled shuffling sounds of a chair being dragged, a door closing. Roscoe, who knew the vaguest nuances of the building, could also tell that Martin had opened a window. There were no screens because Mrs. Delpy didn't abide them. Once a dove had flown into her open living room window and perched on the back of Martin's chair. From then on, she'd wanted to give welcome to any messengers from God, and she often kept the windows ajar even in cold weather, even though they were 5 stories up. 5 times 12 equals 60 feet above ground level. A boy, a man like Martin, might not realize the danger of such a thing. He might not know the consequences of a drop, were he to jump, were he to fall. Nobody could survive a splat like that.
Mr. Jones, she said, turning her head slowly toward him, as though she'd known he'd been there all along, would you kindly open this door?
She smiled her snaggled smile, and he closed his eyes upon the visage of her before her bloated features ruined his auditory pleasure. He thought of the boy Pablo from Marianella, and he pretended himself blind so that he would hear her resonance without seeing her. He stepped forward and sifted through the 49 keys until he found the one that would release Martin from his self-imposed exile. He held it against the lock for a moment before he inserted it, suddenly afraid of what they'd find. Then he turned the key.
Gently now, said Mrs. Delpy from behind.
He pushed the door open slowly. The room at a glance was chaos. The bed was unmade, the floor littered with clothes and wads of tissues, the overhead and lamp lights bright, even though the day was still hours from sunset. An enormous crucifix hung above the bed,
and on either side of it, portraits of Jesus that Martin had drawn in the style of a graphic novel. There were dozens of pictures on the walls, hundreds even. In the one beside the closet door, Roscoe thought he recognized himself.
"Martin?"
Mrs. Delpy called. There was no hint of alarm, no criticism in her voice. She hurried to the closet and closed her eyes for a fraction of a second, then carefully opened the door. She flipped the light, but she didn't need to. It wasn't a large closet, and even with it dark, she knew he wasn't there. She spun around to Roscoe, her eyes open like portals. One hand flew to the cross she wore at her folded neck, and the other pointed to Martin's empty window, which was framed by gossamer curtains shifting on the spring breeze. Roscoe, suddenly nauseated, went to the sill. He was in no rush to climb onto the chair that Martin had moved in front of it. He was none too eager to see the broken man-child splattered on the sidewalk 5 stories below. But of course, he had to be the one. No mother should see her child like that. He stepped up and leaned out, readying himself for the nightmare that would end all hopes of a decent sleep for a while, or maybe forever. But when he looked, finally, beyond the ledge, there was nothing. Only pedestrians with their briefcases and strollers and dogs, taxis and pavement, and the fire hydrant that had been used twice in the building. No shattered body, no blood, no screaming witnesses. Then to his left, a dove cooed, and he turned. This was one of 2 floors that were girdled by a light-colored limestone ledge that extended 18 inches beyond the dark brick face of the building. An intermediate cornice, it was called. Roscoe had always thought it was an overly complex name for a ledge, but whenever real estate agents mentioned it to prospective tenants, they raised their eyebrows and nodded. Apparently, they liked the sound of it. Looking up at it from street level, the effect was a pleasing pinstripe around the 4th and 5th floors. Looking at it from Martin's open window, it was a death trap. 4 or 5 feet to the left, Martin was crouched against the exterior wall, stark naked and cooing to the sky.
"Martin!"
Roscoe yelled. Panic, relief, anguish, anger. Martin jumped a little at the sound of his name, and he made a strange shrieking sound with his dove voice. Then he stood up, a bit too quickly, and flapped his arms to steady himself. He fluttered on the too narrow ledge, even closer to the 60 feet of dead space that separated him from the sidewalk below.
"No, Martin, stop! You'll fall!"
Behind him, Mrs. Delpy tried to squeeze alongside him onto the chair to see for herself that her son was alive.
"Is he all right? Move over, please," she said, shoving him.
"I need to see Martin."
"I'm going out. He's too close to the edge."
He looked down again at the sidewalk, then again at the impossibly narrow ledge upon which Martin was standing, and he swallowed the coppery taste that coated his mouth like a film. But as he was about to lift his knee to hoist himself out onto the precipice, Mrs. Delpy pulled him back inside by the pant leg.
"He doesn't know you, Mr. Jones. I'll go," she said in that resonant, convincing tone.
Faster than a rolling O was her voice, stronger than a silent E. "Get down off that chair and help me up."
But when Roscoe looked back down at her, he saw what would happen if he let her heave herself through Martin's window, a fleshy zeppelin hurling to the ground, the floral tent dress doing nothing to slow her fall. And then what? A naked birdman child flapping his skinny arms and flying off his perch after her, cooing into the rush of wind.
"No, Mrs. Delpy, you just call out to him. Tell him he'll be fine. I'll get him. Take my cell phone. Call for help," he said, handing it to her. "Just in case."
Before she could grab his pants again, he climbed out the window. Martin, glaring at Roscoe, shrank into a squat and flared his elbows akimbo.
"Martin, my sweet," crooned the radio voice behind the window. "You do what Mr. Jones says. He'll bring you back to Mama's Nest, my love. Tuck in your wings, now."
Roscoe pressed his back flat against the brick, holding onto the window frame as tightly as he could with the slippery, damp fingers of his imperfect hand. And to give himself strength, he closed his eyes for a moment and thought of the tune "Limehouse Blues" by Roy Eldridge and Dizzy Gillespie, the way they traded trumpet solos back and forth, playing high notes toward the end,
all the way up to a double high B-flat. And with the tempo in his head, he opened his eyes, took a breath deep into the recesses of his aging body, and let go of the window frame so he could inch along the ledge above a fatal depth of sky. A gust of wind off Lake Michigan pulled at the hairs on his arms.
"Tuck in your wings, Martin," she called.
Martin shrieked again and flapped his arms even more vigorously as he moved further away from Roscoe. His eyes, wide and panicked, darted here and there, over his shoulder, at the sky, at the building face, at Roscoe. His skin was pale, too pale, Roscoe thought, and too tightly stretched over his ribs. He did look like a bird, a baby bird without feathers.
"Martin," Roscoe said, and stopped. Slowly, slowly, staying as close to the building as he could, he extended his left hand, his good one, to Martin.
"Come on with me. Let's go back inside."
Martin flapped harder.
"Martin, my dove, let Mr. Jones help you back inside. It's cold out there," Mrs. Delpy said.
Against the brick window frame, her fingertips were white.
"You'll catch your death in this breeze."
One afternoon, shortly after Martin and Mrs. Delpy moved into their apartment on the fifth floor, they walked down to the lobby and introduced themselves to Roscoe. Rather, she introduced them. Martin stood next to her with his feet in a line, one out in front of his body, the other behind, rocking. He was staring at something on the wall behind Roscoe, and as he shifted his weight from one foot to the other, he snapped the fingers of his left hand.
"My name is Janet Delpy," she said in her serene, buttery voice, "and this is my son, Martin."
She put her hand against the small of his back, and although Martin continued to rock, he slowed down. He didn't take his eyes off the dust motes, but he did incline his ear toward her. Without meaning to, Roscoe closed his eyes and inclined his ear toward her, too. Her voice was a compass, a beacon. He hadn't slept well the previous night, and the luxury of her voice made him want to sink to the floor and curl under the blanket of any story she would be willing to tell.
"Martin doesn't talk," she said, glancing at Martin and smiling. "But he can draw. He draws beautifully, don't you, my love?"
She looked back at Roscoe.
"He'll draw you, probably tonight. He has a gift for capturing detail."
Martin rocked back and forth, gaining something like a quarter inch each time. Snap, rock, rock, snap, rock, rock, snap. His gaze never met Roscoe's face. How could Martin draw him if he didn't see him? Roscoe turned to see what it was that had captured Martin's attention. There was a reception desk, a lamp, an eggshell white wall behind it, and the moat-filled air in between. Roscoe turned back to Mrs. Delpy.
"Nice to meet you," he said. "Both."
Mrs. Delpy smiled and inhaled a deep breath of new air. She looked around at the high-ceilinged foyer.
"If you don't mind, Martin likes to spend time in open spaces like this."
She looked at Roscoe.
"He'd never hurt anyone,"
she said, turning the volume of her radio voice low.
"People don't always know that, though. Maybe you could keep an ear out for Scuttlebutt. Let them know he's harmless."
Roscoe held out his hand and slid an inch closer to Martin. Down below, passers-by had started to gather, pointing, murmuring their concerns, strollers and dogs and lattes in hand. Martin flapped and shivered, goosebumps covering his pathetic heft, his exposed penis retracted against the lake-licked cold.
"Come on, Martin," Roscoe said.
Unbelievably, he was getting comfortable on the intermediate cornice, 60 feet above death. He could feel a rhythm to the wind off the lake, and braced himself against it with the brick against his back. He had known this building from the inside since he was a child, and now he was getting to know it from the out.
"Give me your hand," he said.
Martin demurred.
"The fire department is on its way,"
Mrs. Delpy cooed from the open window.
"Hold on tight."
To which of them she was speaking, Roscoe didn't know. Roscoe looked at Martin. Skinny thing. How old was he anyway? 25, at least. Maybe 30. Each time Roscoe moved closer, Martin retreated the same number of inches. He didn't want to be captured, that was clear. And there wasn't room enough in the ledge for a scuffle, even if Roscoe were so inclined. There was nothing to do but to keep Martin company and wait. The wind quieted. And after a minute or so, Martin stopped his flapping
and let his arms drop to his sides. Turning toward Roscoe, he shifted his feet apart into his customary stance, one in front, one behind, and began rocking. Rock, rock, snap. Rock, rock, snap. He was moving in Roscoe's direction, a quarter inch at a time.
"How is he, Mr. Jones?"
Mrs. Delpy called from the window, her voice betraying none of the gravity of the situation. So placidly did she speak, she might have been asking about someone's distant cousin, someone's pet fish.
"He's calmed down. He's rocking toward me."
"Come home, sweet boy," she called. "Gently now."
In the 6 or 7 minutes Roscoe had been standing on the edge of death, he'd accepted the precariousness of their situation. He allowed himself a long look down. Someone with some sense was shooing back the flock of spectators, clearing the space on the sidewalk directly beneath them. Roscoe considered the crowd. Why would anyone want to stand so close to a bloodbath? A small child pointed up at them. Roscoe waved back.
"Why are you out here, Martin?"
Roscoe asked, still waving. Rock, rock, snap. Martin had covered about a half a foot of limestone. Far in the distance, Roscoe could hear a siren. He wondered who would reach him first.
"You must have a reason. People don't just climb out onto ledges 5 stories up unless they have a reason."
Martin glanced around, agitated again.
"Please, Mr. Jones," Mrs. Delpy said low, warning. "Let's not."
Roscoe put his hands in his pockets, but he was not quite resigned. He was separated from death by only 60 feet, and perhaps only seconds or minutes because of Martin. Didn't he have the right to ask why they were out there? Didn't he deserve to know?
"He can't speak, Mr. Jones. He can't tell you anything. Just leave it. The fire department will be here shortly."
Her voice tranquilized them both. Martin continued to rock, but more slowly. Roscoe looked at the crowd on the street as though they were the ones on stage. Those down below were the performers, not Martin, not him. Then he had an idea.
"Do you sing, Mrs. Delpy?" he said.
"Do I sing?"
"Yes," he said, watching Martin. "Do you sing?"
"Might we talk about that after my son and you are safely inside?"
"I was thinking," Roscoe said without turning his head. "If you were to sing something, maybe he'd come closer to us."
But he had to admit, dangling in the wind, vulnerable to whatever fate would do, that he would like nothing more than to hear Mrs. Delpy sing.
"Well, yes," she said. "I used to, but since I haven't for a long time."
"How about Bye Bye Blackbird?" he said quickly. "But slow. Can you do that?"
There was a pause. Roscoe looked at Martin, whose head had cocked at a particular angle. He couldn't talk, but he could hear. He could listen. Then from the window, slow and deep and unexpectedly sure.
"Pack up all my cares and woes, feeling low, here I go. Bye-bye, Blackbird."
Roscoe watched Martin close his eyes.
"Where somebody waits for me, sugar sweet, so is she. Bye-bye, Blackbird."
The siren wailed nearer, almost an accompanist. Roscoe's 9 fingers ached for his trumpet and a B-flat note. A new breeze licked him back against the building. Why had he never thought to ask her to sing before?
"No one seems to love or understand me, and all the hard luck stories they keep handing me. Where somebody shines a light, I'll be coming home tonight. Bye, bye, Blackbird."
The crowd below parted, and the fire truck pulled alongside the cracked sidewalk and unfurled its articulated boom lift.
"No one seems to love or understand me."
Someone, a firefighter, was speaking at them through a megaphone, but Roscoe couldn't make out what he was saying. He saw the yellow turtle hat, the bunker gear, the basket rising up toward them, defying gravity 1 foot at a time.
He looked at Martin, who'd stopped his rocking and was instead watching a pair of mourning doves who'd flown up and perched on the limestone cornice between them. Mrs. Delpy's messengers from God.
And all the hard luck stories they keep handing me.
Roscoe moved toward the doves, toward Martin. The boom lift rose. Mrs. Delpy sang. The crowd watched.
Was there a God?
Where somebody shines the light.
Martin closed his eyes again, and Roscoe moved closer. The birds swiveled their heads. Who knew what they were thinking, if anything?
I'll be coming home tonight.
The firefighter who met them at the edge of eternity was young, too young, Roscoe thought, to be so elevated. But he smiled as he reached out his ungloved hand toward Roscoe.
No. Roscoe shook his head. I'm fine.
He inclined his head. Get the boy first. Gently, the firefighter took hold of Martin's arm and helped him into the basket. He took off his coat and put it around Martin's bird-like shoulders. Once inside, Martin planted his feet in his comfortable way and began rocking once again. Rock, rock, snap. Rock, rock, snap. But he was safe now. Roscoe would install burglar bars that very day to ensure that such a flight would never happen again. The firefighter then extended his hand to Roscoe. Roscoe met it with his own, the defective one, the one with the missing middle finger, and he clasped the young man's capable hand and allowed himself to be led into the basket next to Martin.
Bye, bye, blackbird.
Thank you, Roscoe whispered. But to whom he was speaking, even he wasn't sure.